Tonight on Arena. We review the week's new films, discover INO's cunning little vixen, and Simon Stevens talks about a slow fire. You are very welcome along to Thursday night's Arena. You can text us on 51551. Our WhatsApp is 0870 32 32 32. You can email arena at rte.ie, and we are on Instagram at rte underscore arena. Now that we have all of that out of the way, tonight, The Tragedy of Hamnet, the Irish man behind boxing great Prince Nassim, and we're going to look forward to 2026 on screen. It is the season for awards buzz. There is nobody buzzier at the moment than Kerry's Jessie Buckley, who's picking up nominations everywhere and awards already for her stellar work on Hamnet. There's more Irish interest in Giant, which stars Pierce Brosnan as Brendan Ingle, the Irish coach behind legendary 1990s boxer Prince Nassim Hamed. Serena Bellissimo and Donald Clark join me now. I should add, we're going to be asking them for their most anticipated films of 2026 as well. But first to Hamnet. The film centres on the true story of William Shakespeare and Agnes Hathaway's meeting, marriage, and then the death of their 11-year-old son. Paul Mescal plays Shakespeare, Jessie Buckley is Agnes, along with an impressive ensemble of Irish actors in supporting roles as well in this. Donald, this is about Shakespeare's family, but really and truly this is Jessie Buckley's film. There are precious few who can hold film the way she does here. So tell us a little bit about the woman she plays, about Agnes Hathaway first.
That's right, yes. Well, it's a film about grief. There's something in here about the artistic process, which there always will be when you make a film with William Shakespeare at the heart. But essentially, this is about the aftermath of processing grief, a word they wouldn't use in that time, when their son dies of, it seems, the plague, which was ravaging the country at that time. It's a hard sell in some ways, because the film is essentially the first two thirds are building you in that, taking you in that direction, and for the first two thirds you have, I thought, a rather beautiful, it's a bit of an ask here, because there's a sense of kind of like folk poetry about it, and there is an argument that the female half of the relationship is more connected to the soil, more connected to nature, than is the man who's William Shakespeare, who's off in Southwark for large parts of the film, in filthy London, working on his plays. And there's something a little bit maybe sentimental about that notion, that which connects to, you know, the sort of things you sort of see in songs of Sandy Denny and all those sort of things, going back all that era, the womanly connection with the soil. But if you can buy that, then you'll find the first third, two thirds, extremely charming, and the beautiful scenes where you see her first curled up in the bole of a tree, which presses home that argument very forcefully. However, the last third is really the grueling part, when you get to, and there's a sense throughout it of largely unspoken of the fact of the argument that she is grieving openly in a way that he is not. She is expressing the inner emotions. She's allowing the inner emotions to escape in a way that he is not. And there's a sense of kind of unspoken blame in that, not least because he's not there all the time. And I think you're right, Rick, that there's almost nobody else there who can connect with that degree of raw passion. And I think what's extraordinary about her is the extent to which she gives so much in this, but you never feel that she gives too much. That is a real gift that she has. I mean, you can absolutely see how this could ultimately have turned into something embarrassing. She has, I said in my review in the Irish Times, that I was reminded of something Laurence Olivier said about a production of Oedipus that he did way back in the 1940s. Well, he thought about the suffering of animals when he gives this scream towards the end. And there was a story he'd heard about Arctic foxes who are trapped by placing their tongues on salt blocks in the Arctic, and that scream that they have when they realize what's happened to them and can't escape was what he processed, he maneuvered into his performance. And there's something of Jessie Buckley's performance in that, and it could be too much, it's an awful lot, but it's never too much, and that's a kind of miracle.
Serena, I'm going to be very careful about this, the way I use this phrase. Do you feel slightly sorry for Paul Mescal, who puts a great performance into this film, but at the same time is obviously overshadowed by a performance that is this extraordinary?
I know what you're saying, because I think everybody in this film, down to the extras, down to someone who is on screen for maybe 3 minutes, everyone is phenomenal. But Jessie Buckley is just on, she's on another level. She will break your heart. You will be broken. And I'm with Donald when he says it's a film about grief. But before we get to that part where it is about grief, it is also about a woman who is not afraid to be who she is. She is so different. She is so scorned. But she will still continue to be who she is because that's how she will live her life. It is also about love. It is about connection. There's a lot going on in this. And just Jessie Buckley, wow, I agree with Donald. In anyone else's hands, this could have been too much.
Yeah.
You're watching it. Like, you're watching that birthing scene. I watched, if you get a chance, I don't know what account it was on, but go onto Instagram and have a look. Just search Jane Fonda introducing Hamnet. And what she says, it's a 2-minute speech that she gives about it. But I was watching that going, yes, Jane, I agree with everything you're saying. She said when she watched that birthing scene on screen, I have never seen a birthing screen done like that birthing scene that Jessie gave us. Again, in someone else's hands, maybe too much. The grief that she feels when she loses her child, never seen that done before either. She is incredible. If she does not walk away with every awards this season, I don't know what's going on.
Don't worry, we'll have the Oscar conversation. We're way too many things to do before we get to that. I want to play this. It's from the early part of the film. This is Paul Mescal as Shakespeare, having just met Agnes, played by Jessie Buckley, and he's helplessly intrigued by her.
Will we go with you this time?
No, not yet. Hey. I'll miss you. But I have to go, you understand? I
know. I understand.
That's good. Because I need you to look after your mother and your sisters. Will you do that?
Yes.
Will you be brave?
Yes.
Yes. Will you be brave?
Yes.
Will you be brave?
Yes! Ah! Yes, I'll be brave! I'll be brave! I'll be brave.
Okay, that's actually Jacoby Jupe as the young Hamnet in a scene from the film having a conversation with his father who's about to go way back again to London to write some more. Donald, Jacoby Jupe, talk to me about his performance as the young Hamnet.
Well, very convincing. I think Serena's right. I mean, it's cast down in deep. This film cast very deep. Every role, right down to the smallest role, is impressive. And there's a nice little finesse there in that the film ends. I just can't be a spoiler. It's in every the shot is in every review, with Agnes turning up at the first production or the first run of Hamlet in London, and his brother Noah Jupe plays Hamlet in that production, which brings me on to, we'd only be fair if we express a reservation. I do have one reservation with the screenplay here. I don't entirely buy the conversion of their grief or the role of their grief in the creation of Hamlet. Now, clearly there is a connection. It's pointed out at the beginning that the names Hamlet and Hamnet were essentially interchangeable at that point, so it'd be foolish to suggest there wasn't a connection or a tribute being paid in the naming of the play. I don't entirely buy that the connections that they make in terms of the content, as we would now say, of Hamlet to them dealing with their grief of the son. That doesn't entirely convince me, and seems as well too neat a way to treat the creative process. It's like, this is how this happened. It's an origin story, like in a superhero film. Here is how Hamlet came to it. I don't quite buy it, but that's a very minor quibble, because the scene at the end when she does encounter the play is sufficiently emotionally powerful that I stopped worrying about that until I was left the cinema and making some notes about it.
I think that there is one moment in that scene, and I don't think any of us should spoil it for anybody, but it involves that. Mm-hmm. And I'm making a gesture that I've spoken to. Everybody I've spoken to who's seen the film has said that pretty much stopped the experience for them completely in the best possible
way. It's a physical performance as well. I mean, that's worth pointing that out, that it's not just a vocal performance, it's a physical performance as well.
Serena, do you have reservations?
Yeah, I do. I have to say, look, when I walked out of this film, the first thing I thought was, if I could hang a piece of cinema in the Louvre, this would be it. I think it's art at its finest form. It is a masterpiece. I don't think this is going to be for everybody, though. And that's not, I don't want that to take away from the film, because I do think it's a great film.
But what stage are you, it's interesting that it's done well in awards so far, particularly for Jesse, but it's won audience prizes everywhere. It won the audience prize at Toronto International Film Festival, and that's punters as well as
again,
experts.
That is film buffs.
Film
people
festival
who
punters.
Go
yeah.
to film festivals mm-hmm. are into film,
sure,
are into the
fair.
Art form. And that's not to say if you don't like this, you're not a film buff and stuff, but I just think that in January, when you're trying to escape from everything, this is very heavy. And I just think that you're not, if you're going for escapism, this isn't the film for you. I also have read I went onto Rotten Tomatoes going, is it just the critics who are giving this major kudos? Really funny, has a higher audience rating than a critic rating. But where the audience are saying they're a bit let down, they're just going, I feel like it's going on for a little bit too long.
Maybe, and this is something that might connect to that, Serena, the idea that, and I've seen it being referred to as, again, very large air quotes, grief porn.
Yeah, but I think the way it has been done, I don't know if I would go down that route, because there's so much that happens before that. And like you were both talking about not wanting to give spoilers, but the fact that we know that the son dies, and I was still in shock when the son dies, will tell you how well this film is put together. Like you go in, you can go in and know everything about this film, but then you will get so lost in it that when you're going, no, this is definitely going down one way. I don't know why they told me the son was going to die. And then it happens and you're still left in shock. That's clogging.
Well, I also say I don't buy this criticism at all. I mean, grief is a fit subject for a serious film or novel. And, you know, if you're going to call this grief porn, then you can call, you know, bicycle thieves poverty porn, or you could call taxi driver lunatic porn. These are fit subjects for films to treat, and it is, I think, crazy to suggest that it's not treated in some depth and with some nuance.
And Chloe Zhao's touch as a director?
Yeah, well, she had a really interesting career. I mean, at Nomadland was obviously a famous success during the COVID years, and won the Asterix Oscar that year, though I think that's unfair to the film. It was actually a very fine film, and The Rider before that, which I think what she has is a gift for stillness. Her films have a kind of contemplative stillness throughout them that gives you time to kind of sit back and think. Even Eternals, her somewhat misbegotten MCU film, which, I mean, had its virtues, but I think she was not the right person for that material. But even that had that kind of like stillness within it, and certainly you get that here.
Okay, let me get some stars from both of you, Donald.
I'm going the full five. Why not? Why begrudge it?
Can I give two? Can I give five?
I was concerned you were giving two.
Yeah,
I was
going to
say
two.
Really interesting conversation. Okay.
No, I'm giving two ratings. I'm giving five as a piece of art. I think it's amazing. But I think as it's not going to be for everyone, so I'm going to give it a four as well for, yeah.
And just briefly from both of you, in terms of Jessie Buckley's chances of winning an Oscar, Serena?
If she doesn't, there's something wrong.
Donald?
I think she's the biggest favourite in 10 or 15 years. The only person who could beat her, I would say, is Rose Byrne from an upcoming film called If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You. We'll see what happens with the Globes on Sunday. We expect them both to win because they're in separate categories. Mm-hmm. Rose Byrne's in the comedy section. I think she's the only person who could beat her, and she could beat her. She won a lot of Critics Award, Rose Byrne, but I think Buckley is safe.
Okay. Next to Giant, the story of the relationship between Prince Nassim Hamed and his Irish coach, Brendan Ingle. Pierce Brosnan plays Ingle. Amir El-Masri is the charismatic featherweight champion Prince Nassim. Serena, as I understand this, you are a connoisseur of the boxing movie. So,
yeah.
Two questions. What elements do we need for a great boxing movie, and are they in this one?
Yeah, so when it comes to cinema genres, boxing is up the top as my favourite. I blame it on my parents because I love the Rocky films. The reason why I love the Rocky films, besides him being an Italian stallion, we've got the connection there, but it is because in a boxing film, I'm a pacifist, by the way, and when the boxing scenes are on, I'm usually sitting there with my hands over my eyes. So it's not necessarily the boxing part that I'm enjoying. I'm enjoying the fact that it is always about an underdog. It is always about someone being told, you can't do this. And all you need is someone to believe in you. And when you find that person that believes in you, you sort of make your way to the top. And it's not always an easy ride to the top. But when you get there and you overcome those hurdles and stuff, it's always well worth it. This has all of those ingredients, and it's gritty, right? So we need grittiness as well. It's not the most perfect boxing movie you will see. I think I really enjoyed Pierce Brosnan's performances in this as Brendan, as well as Amir Al-Masri's performance as Prince. But I think where this film let me down just a little bit is that, like in Prince Naz's life, where he was just like, this is about me, it's supposed to be my story, it became more about Brendan, the coach. And I think in a boxing film, it's supposed to be on the boxer themselves. And I get it was part of Brendan's story, but I felt it became too much of Brendan's story. And I have to say as well, this when I saw that Sylvester Stallone was attached to this, he was executive producing this, I thought we might have just a bit more about the boxer rather than about the manager.
Okay, I want to take a clip here. This is from very early on in the film. It's a young Nassim Ahmed showing early signs of self-belief.
And in the red corner, all the way from New Jersey, USA, we have marvellous Marvin Hagler! Marvin! Marvin! Marvin!
And in the blue
Marvin,
corner,
Marvin,
all the way Marvin, from Winkerbank, Marvin, Sheffield,
Marvin! Marvin! Marvin!
Nassim Ahmed!
What are you doing? We're meant to be playing legends.
We are.
So pretend to be a legend. Ali, Smoking Joe, Sugar Ray.
Why would I pretend to be anybody but me?
Right, lads, grab your bags. We're going uptown.
Gladly.
Good night.
Think I'll get a fight tonight?
Fifth time lucky. Love the headband now. You look grand.
Thanks. Come on now.
Donald, remind us of Prince Nassim Ahmed. He was this major icon of boxing in the 1990s.
A huge icon in the 1990s, and I think that was to do with his success in the ring, obviously, but also to do with, well, to do with the style he brought to it. It's interesting. They work really hard in this film, which I think is a flawed film, but I think passed the time perfectly amiably. They work very hard to get the boxing scenes right, and I think they're done reasonably well. They're in that kind of nether region. It doesn't look like real boxing, but it doesn't look like Rocky either. It's sort of, you know, it has a certain bit of believability about it. But when you see Prince Nassim in the end sequences, this is often a mistake with films. When you show the real people at the end, you go, oh, that's what this looks like. And he's incredible. I mean, obviously there's a great arrogance in there, but the gloves are always down. The guard is not up. It's like, you know, he's taunting the opponent to punch him every time he's in the ring. His race was important. I mean, this was a Muslim in a world where at that stage there weren't that many Muslims, so he was a very important symbolic figure in that as well. And as I say, the style and the arrogance and the flash were important as well. That all comes through in the picture. It's an interesting picture in that, and this goes to something that Serena was saying, the title is, I think, deliberately ambiguous, that not least because he wasn't a giant, he wasn't heavyweight, he was like 5'2 or 5'3, but you realise it goes on, the title is deliberately ambiguous and probably refers as much to Brendan Ingle, who was a legend in Sheffield, as it does, which is where most of film takes place, as it does to Prince Nassim himself. And he was an admirable figure who, and towards the end, we see he gets a very grand funeral at the end and was treated as a real Sheffield hero who helped young kids who perhaps might have, you know, gone to the bad into the boxing ring, which is a traditional thing with boxing always. It was a way off the streets and produced other champions apart from Prince Nassim. But the story is, like, fortunately, a little bit, well, no, it's not too familiar. It is a familiar story. And it's actually, in some ways, the story of Woody Allen's Broadway Danny Rose, which where Woody Allen played the agent who, every time he gets someone in the point of success, they're snatched up by somebody more glamorous with more money. Now, in this case, he got a lot further than that. But down the line, ultimately, you know this relationship's going to fall apart. And I think they handle that quite nicely. That's a very good basis for a film. Brosnan is pretty good, but you and I, Rick, were saying off air, the accent again is meandering all over the island and somewhere across the Irish Sea.
Well, let's have a listen to it so people can make up their own minds. This is Prince Nassim getting a pep talk from his coach, Brendan Ingle, played by Pierce Brosnan.
They'll hate you because you're different. They'll hate you because you're better. Let them. It's the reason the halls are packed for your fights and half dead for the rest. Same every tournament, right? Yeah. Let them hate you. Let them hate you. Never let them steal what's yours, okay? You hear me?
Yeah.
You get what you've earned, what you're owed. And you don't ask politely. You take it. You demand it. Respect, recognition, all of it.
And how do I do that?
Your training every day to their 3 days makes you what?
Better.
So, doubling down and training twice a day will make you what? It'll make you unbeatable. Go on now, get in that ring. You know four ways to fight? Well, now you're going to learn the fifth.
And let's leave it at that. Can we get some stars, please, Serena?
I'm going to give this 3.5 out of 5. If you're looking for a boxing movie, this might be the one for you this January.
Donald?
None more three-starry.
Okay. Finally, this evening, we've asked both of you to tell us about your most anticipated films of 2026. A couple from each of you. So, Serena, let's start with you. What are you looking forward to this year?
Okay, I had to go with the most basic one, which is, you're not going to be surprised, I'm saying the Devil Wears Prada 2. There has been such excitement about this.
Surprise me.
Yeah. I have three in my list
before
that.
The Odyssey.
Okay. Yeah.
No, I just think there was such excitement last year when it was shooting in New York. We never, like, there was always talk about, will they come back, will they not? Now they're coming back. I'm a little bit nervous about it because, you know, just because the first one was good doesn't mean something almost 20 years later is going to be as good.
Does the weight of expectation on something like that increase the jeopardy?
Yeah, and that's what I'm really afraid of. And I feel like we know so much because we've seen, there's an element of surprise to it. All we know is that it's going to follow Miranda Priestly and her struggle against Emily, who used to be her former assistant, but now she's turned rival executive as they compete for advertising revenue in this declining print media, right? So that's all we know about it. But we have seen all the style, all the fashion from all the paparazzi shots and stuff. That doesn't mean that I will not be the first one there. Watch, as soon as that press email comes out going, Devil Wears Prada 2, I will be there. And I think that there's a lot of us. We'll all be going to watch that.
Okay, what about you, Donald?
A few have mentioned, I mean, there's a few that may or may not turn up in 2027. I'm looking forward to Pavel Pavlikovsky's...
27?
26. Pavel Pavlikovsky's 1949, based on a Colin Tobin novel about Thomas Mann. That may not arrive. Terrence Malick's Way of the Wind, his film about the Christ, which I talked to Aidan Turner about during the pandemic when he'd shot it. That's how long that's been in the editing suite. So that could turn up, but maybe not. I'm looking forward to Maggie Gyllenhaal's The Bride, which is arriving when they're voting actually for the Oscars. It's Jesse Buckley here playing in a variation on my favourite film of all time, Bride of Frankenstein. The trailers look bananas. That's a good thing.
Yeah.
The two films I'm putting as my picks, so I'm cheating. I mean, two films as my big picks. One I've seen and one I haven't seen. I'm going to recommend The Testament of Anne Lee by Mona Fassfault, which is from the same team that gave you The Brutalist. She's married to Brady Corbett. Brady Corbett directed that film and co-wrote The Brutalist. He's co-writing on this as well. So you can say it's the same team in that, which is a musical about the creator of the Shaker cult in America in the 19th century. It begins in Manchester and then moves to pre-revolutionary America. Amanda Seyfried is incredible in this. The songs which are based on Shaker hymns are incredible, sort of an opera, tremendous. That's with you in February. Another one I'm mentioning, which I haven't seen, is Mother Mary from David Lowery, which is another musical with Anne Hathaway and Michaela Cole as the pop star's fashion designer. Funnily enough, looking at the trailer, what it reminded me of is actually a film from the Brutalist team. It is Brady Corbett's Vox Lux from a few years back. It looks in that sort of territory. Know almost nothing about it bar that, and it has songs from Jack Antonoff and Charlie XCX, which also recommends it. And it sounds like The Bride, so it's one of those things that could go badly wrong or could be amazing. So those are my picks.
I'm conscious Donald has cheated. I'm going to give you at least two more.
Can I just get one? I will give you one more. The one I'm really looking forward to as well. I'm looking forward to that Anne Hathaway one now. Mm. But also The Drama, which is out in April, because this is teaming up Robert Pattinson and Zendaya. I would never have put the two of them in a romantic drama. We don't know much about it. All we know is that this is about a happily engaged couple, and their relationship is put to the test when an unexpected turn sends their wedding week off the rails. Just from the press shots I've seen, just from the trailer, it feels like, and this is by A24, who makes some great indie drama, indie romance as well, it just feels like something out of the 90s, like the good 90s, and I just can't wait to see what they do.
Zendaya is in every second film this year, isn't she?
She is, and it's so funny. I was just like, oh, I could never see Zendaya and Robert Pattinson together. Well, this was one of three that they've filmed, and is coming out this year. We've also got The Odyssey coming out in 2026 with directed by Christopher Nolan, and one that I won't be seeing is Dune Part 3.
Heresy. Heresy, I hear.
Oh, I saw the first one, and I have to say, I didn't go back after
first
that.
I'm in the middle. I thought they were fine, but I ultimately was worn down by the mythology, which got appealed to me.
You loved?
I loved both of them very much. Yeah, very, very much so.
I was
with
so
the mad
bored.
Dune Messiah coming your way.
I'm thoroughly thrilled to see a third part coming to us this year. It has been great to talk to you both. As always, Donald Clark, Serena Bellissimo, thanks very much. He's one of Britain's most prolific and celebrated playwrights, whose hit stage adaptation of Mark Haddon's novel The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime won both Tony and Olivier Best Play Awards. Simon Stevens is once again returning to Dublin and to Glass Mask Theatre for the world premiere of his new play, A Slow Fire, directed by Rex Ryan. In a post-apocalyptic world, two people find themselves bonded together seeking hope and a means of survival. And I'm delighted that Simon Stevens joins us on the line from London this evening. Simon, you're very welcome to Arena.
It's really, really lovely to be back. How are you, Rick?
I'm good. You've written, at this stage, over 40 plays, 5 different continents, 35 different languages is what it says in front of me here.
Yes, this is entirely ridiculous.
But this is your third show at Glass Mask Theatre in Dublin. Yes, so what is it about this new writing theatre that you find so attractive?
It's a disorientating thing, you know, Rick, because I've been really fortunate. I've been extremely fortunate with my working life and with the actors that I've worked with and the theatres that I've worked in. I've been really, really fortunate to kind of open plays in some of Europe or America's kind of more significant and kind of more sizable theatres. But and you can get distracted. You can get distracted if you're drawn towards the crowds, you're drawn towards the kind of like allure and all the elements that come with crowds like that. You can forget why you write for theatre in the first place. I never wrote for theatre in order to kind of put plays in front of thousands of people. I wrote for theatre because of the kind of intimacy and honesty and truth and detail that I think you find in a vanishingly small number of theatres now, but I find again and again when I return to Glass Mask.
Do you think that it's all too easy sometimes to have that lost when the venue gets bigger and bigger and bigger?
Yeah, because it comes with all manner of things that are tremendously seductive. You know, you get paid more if you're opening a play in a 1,000-seat theatre, and you can kind of easily forget why you do it. But when I work with Rex, or when I worked, you know, with Ross last year making Franz Xaver Kreutz's Men's Business, or when I saw the revival of country music, what they remind me of is the potency and the importance of ferocious honesty and real detail. I remember the first time I went to Glass Mask, you know, the first time they were reviving country music, which is a play that I wrote 20 years ago. They offered to bring me over, to fly me over there, to put me up for the night, to take me out for dinner, and then they're going to show me the play. And I thought, that sounds like a great crack. What a great thing to do on a Saturday night. I went to the Glass Mask Theatre, and you must have been there. If you've not, it's what, a 40-seat theatre?
Absolutely.
It's a tiny little kind of intimate space. It's built in the back room of a wine bar, a really good wine bar with a terrific selection of wine and appropriately for a slow fire, a great selection of charcuterie and a rickety old curtain that divides this auditorium of sorts from the stage. And I thought, come on, this is going to be kind of pretty kind of lo-fi. And then the curtain opened and the play started and the acting, Rick, was just world class. And to see world-class acting ferociously and fearlessly applied to a play of mine in a space like that was intoxicating. Within about 5 minutes, I was like, these are my people. These are my people. I'm coming back here again and again, and as much as they'll have me.
The Irish connection isn't necessarily accidental, though. I mean, you have Irish roots. You have an Irish passport. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I got an Irish. My mother was Irish. My mother was from Belfast, and her family going, you know, clearly one of the honours of my life when I first had a play on at the Lyric in Belfast was to go and see the house where my grandmother was born. And raised with kind of 7 sisters in, you know, the 1910s. It was a funny thing. I'm going to be really honest. I'm not going to lie to you. You know, I got the passport after Brexit because I travel a lot in Europe and I wanted to travel in Europe kind of more easily. I really thought the reaction to our decision from the people of Ireland was going to be really sceptical. But actually, what was extraordinary was the energy and the affection with which I was really embraced by my collaborators in Dublin. And then in Cork last year, I worked at the Sound from the Safe Harbour Festival in Cork last year. And it kind of reminded me how deep in the tectonics of our family history the notion of our Irishness is, how important it has always been to my uncles, how important it was to my mum, how important it was to my grandmother. And when I kind of worked in Dublin, worked in Cork, the centrality of literacy and literature, of art and thought and drama to those cities after, you know, kind of growing up in a country where, you know, the word clever is used as an insult as much as it's ever used in any other way, was so bracing and inspiring. I felt really, really honoured to be accepted by the people I work with.
You've got connections with Andrew Scott, the actor, as well. I was lucky enough to see him a few years ago in Seawall in the Project Theatre here in Dublin, and the NT Live version of Vanya. What has that experience been like working with him?
I was going to talk about him, because when he met my mum for the first time, the first thing he said to me, kind of bounded up to me in the bar of the Royal Court, and he said, "I knew you were Irish." He's really... I've often said, to the point where I think he probably gets embarrassed by it, that I think he's perhaps the best actor in the world. I think he's an actor of extraordinary detail and incredible rigor. He's working with him is so galvanizing because he works so hard. And it's a cliche, isn't it? But it's really true, I think, that what defines the world class from the very, 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 very good is the absolute commitment to the work. You hear about football players all the time. You hear about athletes all the time. You hear about writers and musicians. And it's absolutely true of actors and true of an actor like Andrew. He works so tenaciously. Rehearsing with Andrew Scott, there is no coffee break. There's no lunch break. They might be called for the benefit of the stage management team and for the other people working with him, but he's on. And I just find that captivating and inspiring. He inspires me to want to write and to want to be better.
Let's talk about A Slow Fire, which has its world premiere in Dublin at the end of the month. The inspiration came to you in a strange way, as I understand it. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I think for the context of this, just to contextualize this, I've met maybe, you know, 500 professional writers and talked to about 50 of them at length about their process. And I think of every playwright I've ever met, I am the most rigorous planner. I plan my plays, you know, fastidiously, meticulously. A Slow Fire astonished me then when it genuinely came to me in a dream, in one of those kind of dreams you get when you're jet lagged. I was awake at home, having flown back from work in New York, 4 o'clock in the morning, one of those experiences where your eyes ping wide open. And I was trying to get myself back to sleep. And in trying to get myself back to sleep, I started, to my surprise, imagining a story. And the story that I imagined was a play. And the more I imagined it, the more I considered it, the more visceral and clear it became. And at kind of 4:30 in the morning, I just kind of took the time to write down the story of the play on the notes app on my phone. And then thought, I'm never going to return to this again. That's a ridiculous. That's not how you write plays. You write plays by planning them, by being careful, by being rigorous. And 6 months later, I looked at the notes app and looked at the notes and thought, that's pretty decent. It's pretty good. I read it to my son, who has always been my fiercest and most intelligent critic. And when he said to me, "Yeah, I think that works. I think you should write that," I'd trust him. I would trust him not to lie to me about something like that. And so I did. I just needed a 5-week period. I conceived it in the autumn of 2019. And needed just a 5-week period to sit and just write that and nothing else. And then in the spring of 2020. The first pandemic happened, the first lockdown happened. And it was during the lockdown and the COVID pandemic of 2020 that I wrote the very first draft of the play.
Tell us a little bit about what happens in it, because it feels very prescient.
It's a play which is set in an entirely imaginary world, a world, though, that looks very similar to our world. A world of cities that don't exist in our world, but they feel like they might, and in the aftermath of a nuclear bomb, a nuclear attack. And in a lockup, a safe lockup in the edges of a university, in a town that's been attacked by a nuclear bomb, there are two guys who've been safely kept there for 3 years. They've got water, they've got rice, and they've got one other thing that keeps them going, which is the capacity to tell stories to one another. And every day, every night, these two guys, a theology professor from the city's university and a university porter, enact these stories from their life to one another. And we watch them role play moments of hope from their life. And then after a while, a new character arrives, the first stranger they've seen in years, a guy who calls himself Presley. And he has a gun, and he has a generator, and he has some pork. And Presley takes the two of them into a world of darkness.
I mean, that sounds like the perfect play for a dark January. It is a play, though, that has, it does have positivity and it does have hope in it, doesn't it?
I mean, for me, it does. I'm not sure if I'm the most kind of objective or reliable judge of something like that. But for me, it's a play about theatre as much as anything else. You know, these guys stuck in this world, trapped in this world, facing a world outside their lockup that's genuinely dangerous, take solace and return to the solace of storytelling and of theatre making together. And the stories they return to are moments of hope in their lives. They return to hope. And for me, the play is a defiant celebration of the importance and the urgency of storytelling and the urgency of making theatre, even when the world in which that theatre might sit is devastated.
There are echoes of Beckett in it, is that fair?
Yeah. I mean, there's echoes of Beckett in a lot of my stuff, but I think in this play more than others. Beckett's a writer. You know, my second son, his middle name is Samuel, and he's named after the great man. Beckett for me is one of the defining poets of theatre's history. Godot was the first play that I ever read when I was like 17 years old at school. The first play not written by Shakespeare that I ever read. And it landed in my 17-year-old imagination, like the kind of atom bombs that had defined the terrain that he was writing in. You know, he was writing in the aftermath of Auschwitz, writing in the aftermath of Hiroshima, clearly, and trying to make sense of the world that had devastated itself in the Second World War. And it's not a surprise for me that, as you know, in the 2020s, that Beckett's world and Beckett's characters continue to haunt us, because the kind of devastation that he was writing in still resonates, unfortunately, now resonates with a real particular force.
Why is live theatre still so important for you, Simon? It obviously is. Aside from it being the day job.
I think, I'm very hesitant to kind of make analogies with other cultural forms, but I have faith in human beings, you know, Rick. I kind of believe in us as a species in the face sometimes of evidence to the contrary. I believe in the magic that happens when an actor commits herself or himself to an action or a word. And when a congregation of strangers, which is what a theatre audience is, a group of people who've maybe never met one another before, who might disagree with one another, might not even like each other, you know, might not follow each other on Twitter, might even disagree about politics with one another, but they come together and they sit in a room for a while, and for a while they look in the same direction as one another, while a group of other humans enact the possibility of some kind of story to them. I think there's something ancient about that. There's something ancient, and I think I'm reluctant to use the word holy, but I'm not a religious guy. I'm a secular thinker. I'm an atheistic thinker. But in the theatre, the possibility of that kind of spell, the spell of that kind of story, I think there's something sacred about it.
Simon Stevens, it has been fantastic talking to you on Arena. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Thanks, Rick.
Glass Mask Theatre in Dublin presents the world premiere of A Slow Fire by Simon Stevens, directed by Rex Ryan, from January the 20th to February the 14th. It's performed by Ross Gaynor, Fiona Lynchig and Ian Toner. For more information, you can go to glassmasktheatre.com. and you're listening to Thursday Night's Arena. What happens when two very different worlds collide, the animal and the human, is a question that lies at the heart of Janáček's opera, The Cunning Little Vixen. Sharp Ears is the vixen's name. She's caught by a local forester as a young cub and later manages to escape, leaving him forever haunted by her memory. It's at once a fairy tale for adults and children with a lot to say about modern life. American soprano Amber Norelai performs the title role in a new touring production by the Irish National Opera, with Irish soprano Jade Phoenix as the Fox and Irish baritone Benjamin Russell as the Forester. I'm delighted to be joined now by conductor Charlotte Corduroy and director Sophie Motley there with me in studio. You're both very welcome.
Delighted to be here.
Charlotte, who is Janáček's cunning little vixen as sung by Amber Norelai?
She's a great character. I'm not a singer. If I was, I would want to be able to sing this role. She's, you know, she's the underdog, and she's someone who has come up against all this difficulty early on in her life, and yet remains an incredibly feisty, independent, empowered vixen. And I think in that respect, she's probably a bit of a dream to direct and play, because you're given this huge scope of a significant, almost all her life to play with, really. And in opera, you often don't get that kind of scope to see someone grow up and go through all their big life moments on stage. So, yeah, she's an interesting character. She's not necessarily immediately lovable, I would say.
She's smart throughout, yeah, which I think is really important, because often in opera, somebody is in love, gets slighted, and then murdered, or chooses to kill themselves in a lot of the big opera repertoire that you would think of initially. And this is a piece where a woman doesn't die. Yes, a fox does die at some point, but she's an animal, and we're aware throughout the opera that she's an animal. She lies, she cheats, she makes brilliant, smart decisions. She really kind of embodies the idea of being as cunning as a fox, but actually, what's brilliant about this piece is that the animals are more connected to their emotions and their needs than the human characters.
And Sophie, the forester he's a more complicated sort of villain.
He is, yeah. He's a man who is powerful and has a very delicate connection with the forest that he works in, and he decides one day to catch this young fox and bring it home for his children to play with, and he ends up, like, I guess, stuck or torn in this relationship, which is almost a kind of a human to human relationship, yeah, with this creature who's slighted him throughout. And he lives through the opera with a deep sense of longing and loss and need for probably what's actually human connection, but it is how he relates to the fox and the fact that she does outwit him.
I think we definitely need to hear a little something from the opera. This is an excerpt between The Vixen and the Fox. Oh my God, he's so handsome. This is Sir Simon Rattle conducting the orchestra of the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden, and the performers are Lillian Watson and Diana Montague. Now, sadly, we're back to reality. Charlotte, The Cunning Little Vixen, it's one of Janáček's late works. It has maybe a lighter touch than some of his repertoire that might be a bit more challenging.
Yeah, so it does come later in his work. And a lot of his earlier works, Yukatya and all these other things, they deal with incredibly, you know, very, very dark themes, and this is, by comparison, it's charming. I think that's the word to describe it. And it still has at its core some very sincere, very human elements of storytelling and of human error and of all those things. But it definitely captures a different side to his character. And it was clearly very, very dear to him, because the final aria in it, sung by the Forester, is the piece of music that he requested to be performed at his own funeral. So it sort of must have come full circle. And I think it's rather nice if you've spent a career writing very serious, dark music, to think that he reached a point in his life where actually it was time to write something a bit different and think differently about the world, or maybe, who knows.
Have some joy.
Yeah.
Very, very simple, clear joy.
And some play. It's a lot of play in the piece.
There's a lot of play. It's a lot of fun in rehearsal.
Yeah.
We're laughing a lot. There's a lot of crack to be had because it's clear and simple storytelling. Mm. I learned very recently that Ian Fleming wrote Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, which I wasn't aware of. And it, in a way, is there something similar to that, in that Janáček wrote these deep, dark things and then had a moment of light and play?
I'm interested in The Cunning Little Vixen being inspired by Czech fairy tales, mm. and in particular by Josef Lada, the illustrator. Talk to me, Sophie, as director, maybe about his images and about how they influence the look of the set and the production.
Yeah, so Josef Lada has been a huge influence on myself and the design team as we've gone through the design process for this opera, which we've been working on for about 6 months now at this stage. Josef Lada, if you think of a fairy tale image that in an old book that you have been read, you've had read to you as a child, or you have read to a child, that image is likely a Josef Lada image. They're very beautiful animations of rural scenes, but there are also really fantastic images of animals, animals getting married, farmyard animals getting married. But the colours are very muted. The tones are very muted. And that's something that we were really interested in. Myself and Salo Gohalloran, who's designing the costumes, have been thinking a lot about the difference between how do we represent the human characters, how do we represent the animal characters, specifically the animals that live in the forest and are free, versus the animals who live in the human world. So there's a farmyard scene. So we have hens and a dog, who are very different to a jay and a woodpecker and an owl in the forest.
Yeah, because you have an entire natural world to bring to life in this opera. It's not just the main characters.
Not at all. And there are huge, beautiful interludes within the work, which where you can hear the animals moving in the forest. So there's journeys written into the music.
Yeah.
I guess there's probably 90 minutes of music, but a good 20 of those are the setting up of the world. So working with set designer Marie Kearns, we were looking at how do you create a space on tour across Ireland where you can be in a pub or in a badger's set or in a farmyard or outside a pub or in a clearing in the woods or walking through a muddy field on a dark night while it's raining with some sunflowers to your left, which are all very meticulously described in the stage directions in the score of the opera. So it's been a lot of thinking for us, and some of it is down to the cast and to putting the animals and humans in the spaces. But it's been a real journey of how do we create a space which feels open but also intimate.
I want to play a little something else here. We're going to play the Forester's final aria, but Charlotte, maybe you'd set that up for us.
I mean, it's an incredibly poignant, striking moment, and it's sort of this idea of the cycle of time and time coming back on itself and life going on beyond endpoints, whatever that might be, death, anything. He sort of comes to realise that life will keep passing by, and he takes time to reflect on how he got to, without any spoilers, how he got to the point he's gotten to, and how what goes on beyond that, and it's beautiful.
Okay, let's have a listen to that.
Thank you.
And that's the Foresters' final aria from Janáček's Cunning Little Vixen. Charlotte, the passage of time is a major theme in this, and the changes between animals and humans and that entire world. What's that like to conduct?
I think of it as two different stories of time. I think you've got the human world and how time passes in the human world, and then the animal world or the natural world, and they're just completely different in the way that you approach them. There's a lot of tension and anxiety in the way that Janáček writes the music in the human world, and actually I think less obvious development. It feels, for me, it's all personal, but it feels more stuck in its track.
Yeah.
Whereas you see with the animal world in those scenes, so much motivic development and all these different colours that appear and different romantic elements that start coming in, and the whole thing tends to my ear, feel a lot more organic and natural, and there's a warmth to it. And I think that that's probably... I think it has to have been deliberate.
And Sophie, just maybe very briefly, because we're up against time, but I did want to ask you, what is it like to stage something like this for a touring production with so many demands, depending on where you're staging it?
I think the biggest thing actually is thinking about the audience. What's really exciting about particularly this piece is it's a perfect first opera for somebody who's never been to an opera before. It's a story that's very clear. Anyone who's ever listened to a bedtime story or told one will enjoy this and get something out of it. And the key thing about that is the fact that we can see what's happening and we connect to the characters immediately because of this connection of time that Charlotte's mentioning, in that the animals fall in love and get married within 2 minutes, and the humans sit in a Tom Murphy play thinking about love and longing, and it's a really enjoyable thing for an audience. So we think about the audience a lot.
Well, conductor Charlotte Corduroy, director Sophie Motley, thanks so much for joining me tonight. Janáček's The Cunning Little Vixen tours to Tralee, Cork, Limerick, Galway, Sligo, Letterkenny, Navan and Dúnlíre from the 5th to the 22nd of February. And more details are at irishnationalopera.ie. That is it for Arena tonight, produced by Sinead Egan. Paula Shields is our researcher. Ollie Hamilton is the broadcast coordinator. And sound supervision tonight was by Paul Murnoch. Fíochna Ó Briain is next. I'll talk to you tomorrow.